Hello and welcome to episode 354 of the Apologue Podcast. I am your host, Simon Head. This podcast is brought to you in part by BetterHelp. Get convenient, safe, and secure online counseling today. You can connect with a therapist of your choosing in minutes by taking the online survey. Use the code word Apologue to get 7 days for free when you go to betterhelp.com/apologue. Seasonal depression is a real thing, people, and it's a long winter, and we're in Canada, and it's dark right now, and it's only 5 o'clock. So, go get help now. It's you'll be very helpful. It'll be very helpful, and you'll be very grateful for the help. Also, if you want to support my work on a monthly basis, go to patreon.com/apologue. Pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. Go buy no more t-shirts. T-shirts coming. Don't worry about it. If you want to subscribe, rate, and review the shoe. If you want to subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, don't forget, give it 5 stars, please. Like and share on Facebook. And by going to facebook.com/apologuepod, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at SimonHead666. Spotify, it's a new thing. There's about 50 episodes up on Spotify. I actually updated the RSS feed to include like the Chris Hanna interview from Propagandy and some, you know, Jay Myrus, like just people that happened a bunch of years ago that are, I think, need, you know, still need to have a little bit of a shot at, you know, success. Those Propagandy guys, they need all the help they can get, right? So today on the show, I have Sean Barrett. Sean Barrett has written a book. The book is called Heartstrings Versus Guitars. He did it completely self-funded, which many of you probably know already that I think is a very commendable thing to do, is when you make art, you should just go do it. Go make art and don't worry about the dollars, bills, because if it's good, it'll follow. Money will follow. And Sean's book is, I've read half the book already. It's a great book. And I think you can pick it up on Amazon. You can pick it up on all the places you go buy books. There'll be more information in the description of this episode. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Sean Barrett on the Apologue Podcast. I don't think we've actually ever met in person, but you've the first 7 pages of your book, and like I know all those people, so right? We should know each other. I mean, you mentioned your first concert being a Platinum Blonde concert, and I worked for Platinum Blonde. So
did you really?
Yeah, I was their monitor guy. Yeah.
You know what? Here's my thing on Platinum Blonde. I think I said this in the book. Like, they were such a legit great band and great musicians and stuff like that. The 80s were such a weird time for music, because it all became so visual with videos, right?
Oh yeah.
And then, you know, so you got these guys who are like great players and writing really good songs, and they got some good insightful lyrics, and then they're dressed in like white jeans and red leather jackets and shit.
It's like, okay. It's like, it, you know, the whole, I was just talking to a friend about this the other day about like image-based rock and roll. I think we're just now starting to realize, like, it doesn't matter what you look like. It's how you sound and how it feels. This is like a whole new thing that Europe was doing 20 years ago. I mean, about not having image-based music is, I think we're in a better place for some reason. Like, old fucks can, like, make music again and be recognized for it.
Yeah, I hope so. I would really like for that to be the musical world that we live in, you know, especially because like, I'm 53, so
me too.
You know, I'm not getting any younger. And I think my recording and playing days might be over, although I never say never.
Yeah.
But like, I see my kid growing up, he's 19, and a great songwriter, and he's not interested in image at all. I think like most of them aren't. They've actually kind of gone the other way, at least the kids that he hangs around with.
Yeah.
I can't speak for the rest of them.
Yeah. Well, it is weird because I've had this conversation a few times too about back in the 80s, there was like rockers, there was punkers, there was metalheads, there was stoners, there was, mods? There was all those people that were all in their own little camps. And now I have a 20-year-old and a 17-year-old, and they don't care about that stuff. It's like they'll listen to Green Day or they'll listen to hip hop, and they'll listen. It doesn't matter because everybody's getting so much music thrown at them that there's no way you can really paint yourself into a corner, because that would be limiting, right?
Yeah, for sure. And in that regard, I think I've learned a lot from my kids. They turn me on to a lot of new music. So that's kind of, I'll call it, they're returning that to me, because obviously I exerted my influence over them. My son gets really frustrated because he's like, ugh, like everything I write sounds like, you know, some kind of alt country mixed with, you know, mid-90s Canadian rock.
Like, that's awesome.
Right. So they said, but it sounds like you. You know, it sounds, it's something, you know, that nobody else is doing, but that's just from listening to, my old tank of an iPod and sort of the stuff that I had on there. And, I probably fell into those camps maybe more so in high school, but I think I'll blame it on the radio background, but I've always had a really diverse taste in music, and I always listened to everything. Just because it's more interesting that way. I'm gonna back up. I'm blaming that on my radio influence, but like radio is actually the opposite of let's play everything. it's so tightly formatted now. When I started back in 1988, I was working up in Kapuskasing because that's where I'm from. And that was a little AM station. Like, it was a contemporary hit radio station. That format doesn't even exist anymore. And we played everything.
Yeah.
So that was fun. You know, those were the salad days.
Yeah. I radio, terrestrial radio and versus streaming and Spotify. That's an age old conversation, but it just feels like, well, radio has a weird vibe. It is, because it was so kind of like, to get on the radio was like near impossible. Like, right. As a band, the only thing we had was like the Indie Hour, or, you know, Bookie would play something. He'd play your song on a Monday night, or, you know what I mean? There was something to do, that there was some thing, you know, that would be our outlet for us to sort of learn about new music. And even now, if that was a show, it would be on Spotify.
Yeah. Yeah. I was one of the gatekeepers, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I was a music director. So, and a lot of my favorite stuff, like, that I listen to still, like I said, on this old tank of an iPod is stuff that came home with me from the radio station that unfortunately never made it to air. I always tried, because I was part of the music scene too. So a lot of these people were friends and people that I knew reasonably well. So, you know, I would actually try to develop features and stuff like that so that we could get some of the local people on. And I would, you know, there was a brief, beautiful period of time where one program director had left and a new one hadn't shown up yet. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of the PD/MD, and a few people got added around that time to the regular rotation, that kind of thing. So, I mean, you know, I always had the loyalties, but it always pissed me off too, because I think that's what did terrestrial radio in, was, you know, not having this hyper local focus. And then when better options came along, like, people built better mousetraps, man. And like, yeah, I can program my own radio station 24 hours a day and listen to anything I want to and discover all kinds of new stuff.
Yeah.
They should have been, and always should have been, playing local bands, local artists, and talk about what was going on in local scenes and local politics and stuff that was interesting to people. But then they'd say the research kind of didn't necessarily bear that out either. People's tastes tend to veer towards the pedestrian, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, if you use like the record store as an analogy of a radio station, that it was curated. There was some guy behind the counter going, hey, listen to this. This is a great record. And then they'd be influenced because the person owns a record store would say, here, check, you got to listen to this because it's going to change your life. It kind of exists. Like I just went down to a record store in Buffalo that has a bar in it. You know, it's pretty, pretty amazing. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Pretty forward thinking. Right. Like, and that to me is a way to entice people in to listen to music. And then this guy who runs the place, he's worked at a record store his whole life. I mean, it feels like there is a little bit of curation for music. It's curating. It's happening again. It's not influential on a great scale. Like, you know, when I listen to Q107 or if I listened to CFNY 30 years ago, it was like, you'd listen to this and then you'd hear Lois and Low, which is an indie band, or Bare Naked Ladies. And then that's what they played. There was nobody telling them what not to play. There's, I guess, a bit of a takeover of corporations sort of decided, like, maybe, I don't know, you would have better insight to it. It feels like they lost so much money. They're like, you know what? We got to figure this out. We got to figure out how to make as much money as possible.
Yeah, I think they just panicked. They kind of choked. They kind of went all Toronto Maple Leafs. And I mean, listen, lifelong fan over here, but let's face it. I actually mention a guy named Tony Anselmo a little bit later in the book, and he was the owner of Records on Wheels here in Sudbury, and he was that kind of guy as a record store owner who really curated things and turned people on to, you know, music that was going to be a lifelong love for them and influence them as musicians moving forward and that kind of thing. And Mark Browning, who's a friend of mine, he's got a band called Ox, and he has Cosmic Dave's Vinyl here in town now. And I think, I don't know that he's taken on the mantle quite the way that Tony did, because records have become a little more boutique-y and kind of expensive now. Like, you're not picking up a record anymore for $5.99 or $6.99 brand new, you know. But he still does that. You walk in and he's always got something on that sounds pretty good. You know, and I've asked him a few times what he was playing, discovered some new stuff. That's how I discovered Frightened Rabbit and some other, you know, bands who I absolutely adore, right? So I think people can still have that influence, and hopefully people are still influencing each other a little bit. I think, you know, that might be one of the strengths of social media. I wish people shared more music, actually, than they do, you know. Memes are great, but I really like seeing sometimes what people are listening to and what they think is cool. You know.
Yeah, I do know that, like, algorithms are getting smarter. Like, when you're listening to Spotify or Apple Music, I seem to hear something after the record's finished that you've listened to. Something comes on that you hopefully have never heard before, and that to me becomes exciting, because it's like, well, what is this? What is that? Because the greatest thing is, I forgot what band I started listening to. It was either the Nils or something that was sort of a little niche-y, that it was trying to figure out, well, hold on a second, let's figure out what sounds like this. And then it started playing stuff. I'm like, I've never heard the song before. I've never heard that song before. And I'm like, this is almost like a record store guy throwing records at you going, buy this, you know? So
I know
it you know, I'm sure you're a purist in that. And I do, and I'm with you. I feel that there should be an older guy going, you got to listen to this. Or you're too old to, like, you know, there needs to be a passing of the torch. Like, the young guy going, oh, your music's old school, man. You got to listen to this now. This is the new music. That's how the music genres work, right? People.
Exactly.
People.
I do like that algorithm thing. Like, you know, listen, I mean, as a, you know, singer, songwriter, musician, we've all, and anybody who's involved in the music industry probably has a reason to dislike Spotify to a degree, But I think the hate on Spotify goes a little far, and people aren't being creative enough in the way that they decide to use it. Mm-hmm. But I do like that algorithm thing, and I can give you an example. So my daughter turned me on to Indigo D'Souza. So Indigo D'Souza is from North Carolina, and we went and saw her play at the Opera House last May, and she had a band called Sluice open for her, and Sluice were amazing. I love them. So I got kind of hooked. I've got a bit of a Sluice problem, and I listen to their little EP probably once a day, but I'll put it on sometimes and just let it roll. And I've discovered a whole bunch of really cool stuff. I don't know if you ever heard of MJ Lenderman, but MJ Lenderman's really cool. Wicked guitar player, some great songs. And my son had already, in fairness, had already mentioned MJ Lenderman to me. And then it just rolls through this stuff, right? So I do discover a lot of stuff that way. Sometimes I put music on to go to sleep, or just, you know, whatever, when I'm about to go to sleep. And what bugs me is I'm usually diving for my phone to like add something to a list. So I'm like, oh shit, this is also an algorithm, right? So if I don't take action right now, I may not find this song among the 4 billion songs on Spotify, you know, or try to Google it based on like 2 lines or 2 words that I remember when I wake up tomorrow morning. So
that's amazing. That's amazing. So yeah. Obviously you've been in music your whole life. You've played music. You've worked in radio. Mm-hmm. And you've stayed primarily north of in the 705 area mostly.
Yeah.
Well, 705 is a big region, but I mean
it's very big.
Yeah.
I didn't move south of Sudbury. I grew up in Kapuskasing. So for any of your listeners who don't know where that is, just look up and, you know, get yourself up to sort of James Bay and then look down, and right where the trees stop, you'll see Kapuskasing, right on the timber line. So when the north wind blew, it kind of whistled off James Bay and it hits you first. Mm-hmm. And then I did go to school for a couple of years down in London at Fanshawe. I took radio there. I was already in radio. I got into radio when I was 17.
What years were you going to Fanshawe?
I went from 89 to 91.
It's so crazy because I got accepted to go there in 1989. I almost went there. I didn't go there because it was too far.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
So I mean, far. Fuck. Sorry. I guess we could swear on a podcast.
I'll
try and keep it clean.
Nope.
But like London was 12 hours away from Cap. It's a 12-hour drive. Mm-hmm. So and that was my first experience where when it snowed and then the snow went away, the grass hadn't died.
Yeah.
You know, that was new for me. Anyway, I went back up to Cap after college because the radio industry was in flux at the time. I kind of caught the tail end of the good years, and then things started to get automated and everything. So jobs were hard to come by. I finally scored a gig here in Sudbury doing evenings at 790 CIGM, was the country station, and I stayed there for little less than a year, and that was as long as I planned to stay in Sudbury, to be honest with you. I did have every intention of, you know, heading for a major market and eventually landing in Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal or something like that, but life sometimes conspires to not ruin your plans but make other plans. So I got moved over to the rock station, I got promoted, I met my wife, then I kind of stayed here long enough to realize I kind of like it. I like my personal space.
Yeah.
So it's been good, you know, and I have, there's a great music scene here. There's lots of great musicians. So it's got everything I want and fewer people, which is always cool with me. I'm in public relations. Yeah. So, you know, being sort of like an extroverted introvert, or I don't know, you know, some people might call me a misanthrope. I have no idea. But, you know, like it's just I like people, but I like them in the doses that I want them in.
No, I get it. I'm with you. You know? I am with you. Yeah. I mean, I go to these, I work a lot of venues, you know, I'll be working for a band. It's awesome. But if I have to go there as a patron, I'm the worst. I'm insufferable. I'm like, get me the fuck out of here. Like, it's like my favorite band might be playing. And I'm like, at least Palace is like, I can't. I'm not like, what they call it, endorophobic, like fear crowds. But I just think I used to be able to, like, if I wanted to, I could just go to the band room and hang there and not talk to anybody. But now here I am with 600 other people. It's just, I don't know, not into it. Like, you know, even back then.
Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. I hear you. And then, you know, that's all right. It's okay. Maybe it's, I don't know what it is. Maybe there's a limit to how much peopling you can do in your life. And we're just, you know, we're on the down crest of that. Maybe that's what it is. Because like I said, you know, I mean, it's funny because I've always done these public facing jobs too.
Yeah.
You know, from radio to public relations and, you know, I mean, playing music up on a stage, that kind of thing. So people assume that I'm this really extroverted person.
But that's something you can control. You know what I mean? If you're up on stage, that's your space, you know, and then, you know, you don't need to be there. Someone's not going to check your ID every time you walk in the place. It's a whole other vibe for me if I'm a patron, because I look around and go, well, how am I going to get out of here if somebody comes running in here? Like, how is this going to go down? You know, or if I need to go, you know, somewhere quiet, which is awesome, you know, when you play in venues, that's work. If I got to go to a venue, that to me feels like work. So I was like, I don't feel like I can really relax here.
Sure.
I remember the Weaker Thans. You remember the band, the Weaker Thans?
Yes.
They're old dear friends of mine. They used to like stay at our apartment and then play like the Rivoli or the Shanghai, little tiny places. And I remember one day they broke huge. Like, it seemed to be overnight. And then they sold out Lee's Palace. And I'm like looking around like, who are these people? Why are these people here at my favorite band? You know, just...
Yep. Greg Smith, is that?
Greg Smith came on after John Sutton left.
All right.
Yeah. He's the lowest of low guy now.
Yeah, I know. I want to get Greg into my next book, actually, because he came up. They were up at Northern Lights Festival this summer he was with the Fembots. Yeah. And so Dave McKinnon actually engineered and played on my second CD.
Okay.
So it was fun because he came up there. They were just so good. I hadn't seen them live. I missed them somehow. And so that was good. And Greg was playing bass with them. So had a chat to him because he was the only low member actually that isn't in this book.
Okay. Yeah. So. Greg feels music, man. Like, there's nobody. I remember seeing, there was that Weaker Thans documentary, and he steals the show. He's like the best character in that band. And I know and love all those guys. I used to play in the band. Yeah. I used to play in a band with the drummer, with Jason.
Okay.
But Greg has so much energy and so much charisma and so much like it to be like,
yes.
And when he speaks, he's not telling you anything you want to hear. He's just saying stuff he feels. And that's a whole other vibe about Greg. And Greg and I, because we usually take multiple cars to shows, he's my riding partner because I'll go pick him up at his house and then we'll go do a show, and I usually bring all the gear in my trailer. So he's my travel partner, my buddy, and just a sweet sweetheart of a man.
Yeah, so much fun to watch, and you know, really nice guy. I hadn't really spent any time talking to him, and I didn't spend loads of time or anything like that talking to him at the festival. There's a lot going on, but yeah, seemed like a really good dude. I saw him for the first time playing with the Low, which was actually the first time that I had ever seen the lowest of the low, you know, because I just never had. And it was pre-COVID, but not by much, in Barrie. That was I caught them there.
What was that place called? It was like a little theater. Like, it wasn't a theater, but it was an old theater.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Beside it used to be called the Roxy, but it's not the. It wasn't the Roxy. Yeah. I was there. I mixed that show.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. See. Yeah. Probably just missed each other, and that was where I met Lawrence. You know, I mean, everybody in that band just is pretty down to earth and just generally pretty pretty nice people. Lawrence, great. You know, I'm chatting chatting with them at the merch table. You know, I don't know. Like, I expect them to be rock stars. I've loved the lowest of the low for so long. You know, but they're all just, you know, really kind of unassuming guys. Probably not back in the day. I remember interviewing Ron back when I was at the radio station, and this interview went on and on. It wasn't an on-air thing. I was recording it. And I think we ended up talking for almost an hour, and it was so long that I was overwhelmed by it and never did edit the interview down. I don't know whatever happened to it, but we had this really like wide ranging interview, and it was for The Rusty Nails. Bite Down Hard was the single at the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, we had a really good talk, and he's kind of an open book at that point, you know, about how things used to be and such. But we kind of reconnected on Facebook, and Ron was one of the first people to say yes to telling me his story. You know, and the idea behind this book, so it's called Heartstrings First Guitars, and the idea behind the book was I was just going to talk to people that I knew. You know, and I know a lot of people. And at first it was going to be maybe just sort of a local book with a few friends who, you know, wherever they happen to be, and a few friends that I have on Facebook or who I've known from over the years through my radio career and stuff. You know, just to add a little bit of spice to it. So, you know, Ron said yes right away. There's a few others who were kind of on board pretty quick. And Tom Wilson, I talked to Tom.
Oh yeah. Junket.
Because we've got a little bit of history. We're not like best buds or anything like that, you know, but acquaintances who, when we see each other, we're happy to see each other, and we can have a bit of a chat and stuff. So I asked him if he'd be in the book, and he said yes. And, you know, he said to get in touch with his manager. So I did. And that was kind of where things took off from, because it was Alan Moy who sort of suggested that, you know, he could maybe get me hooked up with the other guys in Blackie. And, you know, did I want to talk to 5440? I'm like, yeah, do I want to talk to 5440? Of course I want to talk to 5440. Like, you know, I grew up listening to those guys. And then it all kind of just, it just kind of rolled on from there. And it got pretty interesting and pretty fun.
Yeah, so like the premise of the book is, it seems there is some biography part of it with your life, but then you speak to people and they talk about, like, explain kind of how the book unfolds.
Yeah, so the biographical stuff, the autobiographical stuff, I hope people find interesting. It was weird talking about myself, but I had to figure out a way to sort of tie everything together and make it so that I wasn't just, you know, offering some compilation of stories, because I am a writer, you know, and I do express myself in that way. So I wouldn't have felt, it would have been weird to just, you know, here's a bunch of stories and not offer any kind of a narrative for me. So I talk about, you know, my sort of journey through music till now. And then the idea was that these would be little vignettes, like, you know, a couple of paragraphs, no more than 300 words, about their first guitar. We started with first guitar, and then I realized that was going to be a pretty boring book, because most stories kind of start with, yeah, my parents bought me this guitar from Sears, and the action was really high, and I almost quit.
Yeah.
So then I sort of fine-tuned that a little bit to, like, first important guitar. You know, what was the one that lit you up, that made you want to call yourself a guitar player, that made it go, okay, this is for me, this is what I do now, guitar is going to be part of my life probably forever. So that made things more interesting. And I wasn't super strict about it. Like, you know, I'm not going to be overly prescriptive. If people want to tell me a story about any guitar, I'm interested in hearing it. But the idea was first guitars, first important guitars. Mm-hmm. So, and being a bit of a socialist, I guess, I didn't really want to present it like anybody was more important than anybody else. So, like, Gordon Lightfoot got 300 words. and so did my friend Trevor, who's never played for anybody.
That's amazing.
And he was like my first friend ever when we were two growing up on the same street.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. And it's probably weighted about 2/3 of the people or half of the people are not people that most people will have ever heard of. And then the other half can be some fairly notable names. You know, they're gonna see, you know, Rob Baker and Paul Langlois. They're gonna see, you know, Bruce Coburn in the book, and they're gonna see Serena Ryder and Chris Abbott and a number of people, Mo Berg. You know, the list gets long, mm-hmm. but again, like, and it's a selling feature, obviously. Like, you know,
yeah.
I've been around. I didn't just fall off the turnip truck, but I still think that a lot of the most compelling stories are just the regular people, you know, who, or just people like me, maybe they went for it, but didn't quite get there or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like the way you say that, because the story is the same. I got my first guitar, the most important guitar. And the reason is it doesn't matter who you are, if you're Gordon Lightfoot or Joe Schmo. Because
yeah.
the feeling is the most important part of it, of what it felt like to get that first real instrument.
Exactly.
And to me, by intermingling not just classes, but at the same time, notable people the story is still compelling, you know? So
yeah. And the way I laid it out was also, you know, a few people have said, well, you know, like, how come they're... You know, there wasn't, you know, sort of a legend of, you know, like, who's in the book, you know, where you can find the pages, because I didn't want it to be that way.
Right.
I wanted people to have to leaf through the book and, you know, see this name and see that name and read those stories, and then just run into somebody who they were like, holy shit, I love Pete Yorn. I didn't know that Pete Yorn was in this book. And then some of them are weird. I didn't know what I was doing. So let's just put the cards on the table here. I didn't know what I was doing.
I love
because
that.
I've never written a book, yeah. and I didn't have a plan.
I love that.
So I was kind of just reaching out and like happy to talk to anybody or get a story from it. I didn't interview everybody. A lot of people just provided the story, like they wrote it themselves. Mm-hmm. And those are some of my favorite ones, because then it's really in their voice.
Yeah.
But like, you know, so Leona Boyd is in the book and Fred Penner is in the book. And you know, kind of, do you know, you won't know who Stephen Tobolowsky is. I can almost guarantee that name's not going to ring a bell. But if you saw Stephen Tobolowsky, he's like one of the biggest character actors in Hollywood. And for some reason, we have this, like, every now and then I'll shoot him a message on Facebook and he always responds. We'll have a little chat.
Wow.
And I forget why I reached out to him in the first place. But like, what was he in? He was in like, the reboot of One Day at a Time. But like he's a bald guy with glasses. Like I said, if you see him, you'd know right away who he was, and he's a musician. So I was like, you got a first guitar story? He's like, sure. So he told me a story. That's the kind of vibe that I was going for, is I just wanted people to leaf through it. And maybe they're not going to know who that person is. Maybe they'll Google them and find out. Look them up on YouTube and, you know, give somebody who's, you know, got, like me, 6 followers and, maybe 500 spins on any song, and give it one more.
Yeah.
And maybe discover somebody who's, you know, maybe they'll like the songs. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I always have an appreciation and a thirst for of not knowing anything and immersing yourself 100% in it, because there's a type of blind ignorance. That's the wrong word, but you know where I'm going with it. It's like,
yes.
we're just going to go and do it. I did the exact same thing with Lois and Lowe. I just did a documentary on them. I have no idea how to do a documentary. But it's finished.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, man.
That's awesome.
To like, it just came out like in September. It took 3 years to make. I have no idea. It's same thing you talk about Ron. I laugh when you say, well, Ron's first person to ask. I asked Ron, I go, and I prefaced my pitch to him, like, I don't have a clue what I'm doing, but I want to do a documentary on your band. And he was like, okay. I'm like, come on. Really? So that was yeah, that easy. Awesome. Now it's the second, really? The ones I'm doing now, the newer ones I'm trying to do, they're even way harder because it's like, I'm like, well, I kind of know what I'm doing now. So it's like, you know, yeah.
So is it almost like you're a little bit more self-conscious about it? Whereas before it was just this blind wonder.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I hope the second book is kind of like that for me too, because yeah, this one was, there were some like really kind of hilarious moments hilarious to me, maybe not to anybody else, but like, for example, Sal Costa, he's in, well, see, here you go. I'm going to try and tell this story. I still don't know the band that he was in. they were called, he was in, one of them is Bonds of Mara. And then the other one is the one that I should know, but I don't. But they were like in this, their big hit was Porn Star Dancing or something like that. And it was huge. It sold like, it went to number one in the States and sold like 10 million copies or something ridiculous like that. And I got hooked up with him through a friend who's in the industry, Brian Heatherman. He's like, do you want to talk to
Sal? Oh, you know, Brian. Brian works Sonic Envy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lois Hello.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So anyway, he's like, yeah, well, you should talk to this guy. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that sounds great. So we have this really nice chat and he's asking me questions. He's like, so when were you in radio? And I said, well, only until 2002. He's like, okay, well, yeah, you would have missed us because we came later. I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. And so we have this really nice chat and I get a story and it's all good. And then I looked him up and I had no idea who I was talking to.
Yeah, I just looked it up now. It's Smashing Satellites. Is that a band?
That's another one of the projects.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to look it up too, because we can do this, right? Like, we don't have to do this anymore. Yeah. And this is like, you know, it's
this not is what
like
you call the podcast. We have no phony. Right?
I do like that, though.
Yeah,
I
me
think
too.
I think it's Porn Star Dancing. And it really like wouldn't have been my kettle of fish anyway. My darkest days.
Yeah.
And so like Ludacris and Zach Wilde were in the video.
Yeah.
And this was all like some kind of a Chad Kroeger project or something. Anyway, I had a laugh after because I was like, wow, that's kind of ridiculous. Just talking to this guy, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, for a younger audience, he might be one of the more notable names.
Probably not. Probably not.
No, maybe not. Anyway,
I've never even heard Smashing Satellites. I'm like, maybe I switched off like in a certain period of time, but I have no memory of that band.
I did. I switched off in 2002, which was when I left radio, and I stopped listening to the radio just because I was tired of it and bored. And at that point, kind of knew what I liked, and then I sort of went through this period where I didn't really listen to a lot of new music or hear a lot of new music. I heard some, but wasn't much of a consumer of new stuff. And then, to be honest, yeah, it was sort of like when social media started to take off again a little bit, but I'm not going to lie, Spotify makes discovering new stuff really easy. And
absolutely,
man, I'm going to piss off a lot of my friends. Why are you talking about Spotify? Like, hey, dude, listen, you know, like maybe you got to roll with it and think about it a little bit differently in the way that you, you know, promote yourself. I don't know.
Well, you know, we can
some opportunities there is all I'm saying.
We can talk about this because if you're a band and you've put a record out and it's on Spotify and you're making no money, mm-hmm. Well, what's so different than 20 years ago when you try to put your record out to sell, to have on a label, and you would have an independent record label put your record out, you'd still make no money. In fact, you'd probably make way less and you had no control over any of it. And then, by the way, you didn't own any of your masters anymore. So one might argue that by today's standards, if you record a record on your laptop in your basement and it has a marginal success and you could possibly take it and do some shows based on the fact of a Spotify bump, then, I mean, I don't see a problem with it. You know, nobody made money off the radio. Nobody made money from SoCan because their song got played on the radio. Unless you are Bruce Springsteen or Madonna or name any band.
your song came up a lot during those periods when I had to write down the song and who the songwriter was and all that shit.
Yeah.
And kind of keep track of that. What, you know, we did that a few times a year.
Yeah.
The other thing that you know, occurs to me is maybe you're just interacting with your fans wrong. Like, don't, you know, it's like, just look, fine, listen to my stuff on Spotify. But, you know, I mean, if you go over to Bandcamp, you can just say you're going to buy my album for $20 or whatever. You don't have to download it. You know, you could help me out that way and, you know, keep me recording. And, you know, I think artists, instead of thinking of that as like kind of having cap in hand and maybe, you know, sort of not begging their fans, but maybe, because some people feel like that's what they're doing. I think, that there's an opportunity here to, I'm in change management. It's my day job. Mm-hmm. It's what I do. I'm a consultant. And a lot of that is trying to just change people, the way people think about stuff. Like, why does everything have to be transactional? Why do I have to give you $10 and then you give me something back? There doesn't have to be that exchange. Nobody said there had to be that exchange right on the spot. Mm-hmm. So if you're digging my music over on Spotify, go to Bandcamp and
invest
some cash, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever. ask me. We're all pretty available these days. Ask me what my email is and e-transfer me. I don't know. But why do you need like some, you know, set of dots and dashes on an MP3 to make you feel better about the fact that you gave me some money? You know, the world we live in, everybody needs to eat, everybody. And it's not cheap making art, man. It's not cheap making music or documentaries or writing books or any of that stuff. So, you know, this idea that, you know, we should all be satisfied with whatever we get and, you know, keep on doing that off the side of your desk kind of sucks. Like, I mean, I'm realistic enough to know that this isn't likely to be my full-time job anytime soon. You know, I would love for it to be. And I don't want to, put the wrong message out to the galaxy or the universe or whatever. But at the same time, I'm a realist. I spent a lot of years in radio deciding to bring that full circle, this conversation, deciding who was going to get on the radio and who wasn't. Yeah. So there's always been gatekeepers, man.
Yeah.
And it's always been a pain in the ass. And if anybody thinks any different, then they just, you know, don't maybe have enough of a lens or enough history to understand that, like you said, things aren't appreciably different. There was never a whole shitload of money in radio. There's always been a chosen few who were going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then most people weren't, or they were going to get fame,
yeah,
but they weren't going to make money.
Well, that's the problem too. Back in the 80s, when you got your record advance for a 7 record deal or whatever, and it was like $1 million. It's like, that money goes real fast. When you paid $100,000 to have your record made, and then you pay $40,000 in to get tour support, and it all, or you have that restaurant deal and all that backyard, back alley trading, and all, it's like, I sort of came up in sort of the early 90s when the independent record label started sort of taking control of the destiny of the band, and that's great. But towards 10 years later, in the end of the 90s, you're getting screwed by independent record labels. You're getting screwed by major record labels. In fact, it's almost better to get screwed over by a major label, because they're going to honor a contract, because there's a contract, you know? So I had an independent record label rob me of $4,500.
Jesus, eh?
You know, they missed one zero on our advance. Instead of 5,000, it was 500.
Yeah.
I said, no, you've shorted me $4,500. No, we gave you $5,000. I'm like, no, I got my bank transfer. All right, you're dropped. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
So they go, that's what happens. And
it's a lot harder for Universal Music to ghost you than somebody who just folds.
Or in distribution deals. So like, we had a European distribution deal throughout Germany and Italy, all the way over Europe. And all of a sudden, in the early 2000s, the industry just went bunk and nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, all these distribution houses went bankrupt. And then all our records are sitting in these distribution houses. We don't have any records. Like, there's thousands of records sitting somewhere in somebody's storage space. And because the distribution company went bankrupt.
Wasn't that basically what screwed Big Star?
Maybe.
I think I watched their documentary, and that's basically what happened. Like they were like the band that was supposed to be and never were, kind of.
Yeah. I think they were too early for what they were giving up. Had they come out in the late 70s, early 80s, I think, you know what I'm saying, at a different time, they were so revolutionary when you think of their music and how it, you know, I felt like it feels ahead of its time to me.
Yeah, but then you hear REM or Teenage Fan Club or something like that, and you're like, "Oh yeah, okay, I know what you were listening to."
Yeah, it's true.
You know, but that's what happened to them is they had really shitty luck all the time with distribution, and you know, a record company just like whatever fold or something would happen, and it's like, oh, there's your record sitting on a shelf.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of the, and I don't know if this is right or wrong. Some of the advice I got though was, especially with your first book, just self-published kind of thing.
Don't
get hung up on getting a publisher.
No,
and it seems to be working out pretty well so far. I just heard some horror stories from people, like, you know, about, you know, having to buy their books back, and there's no big advances anymore.
No.
So there's not a huge lot of advantage from what I can tell to signing on with a big publisher and then make $2 a book and not really get an advance, and then they give you a 3-month promotional push, and when that's over, if it hasn't taken off yet, you know, then you become less of a priority.
Yeah.
And you know,
it's like the record industry.
I was gonna say exactly like the record industry.
Yeah.
Like there's really no difference, right?
Yeah. Well, when I finish this documentary, I think, to me, I'm gonna pat myself on the back, because I don't think anybody's ever done this. My stroke of genius was to transcribe the whole movie into a book and then sell that over the merch table. And it's been doing gangbusters just over the merch table with Lowest of Low. You know, for me, in 3 months, it sold almost 200 books. I mean, to me, that's awesome. It's pretty.
That's a great idea.
I don't think now everybody's going to do it, right? So, but I think, to me, it's just another revenue source, because you're already gathering all the content. Like, I have I'll show you the binder. Oh, there, maybe you can see it on top of there. Yeah. 600 pages, double-sided printed, typed out by my mom, by the way, that I transcribed all of that, the movie, I transcribed it into a 134-page book. And people love it, especially fans, right? And the cool thing about it is that it'll be at someone's cottage sitting on their shelf, and someone will take that off of the shelf. And, you know, if it was a DVD, we're like, what do you want me to do with this, Grandpa? You know, at least they can read and go like, oh, this is a band, and then they can start checking and then go onto YouTube and find out and rediscover this band when we're gone. And, you know, to me, that's what I'm going to do from now on. If I ever do something, I'm just going to make a little book, a companion piece, because it's to me, it's kind of a cool, and I self-published too. I just went to a printing house, an online printing house, and I made sure it was in Canada. So I got, you know, a better, cheaper, because you're selling, like, you're getting like, what, 30 pounds of books mailed to you. Did you make hard copies?
Yeah, I did. So I learned from making my own CDs not to bite on the, hey, if you buy 500 more, it's only $200 extra shit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm sitting on my desk right now, and I don't know if you can hear that, but those are boxes full of CDs.
yeah, I got some.
So I've got lots of those. So I just kind of done, because you don't save it. I think the threshold's 250. So I got 300 done, then I got 250 more done, and I'm just going to kind of do it like that. And I'm getting them done just by a regular old printer. They're called OJ Graphics. They're in like Espanola, which is about 40 minutes west.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, tell him, hey, John, I'd like 250 more. And it takes about a week, and I just drive there and listen to some tunes and pick them up and drive back. So I'm saving myself the delivery cost, you know, for the sake of a bit of gas. I make that run when I go to our place on Manitoulin Island anyway, so my car knows the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so far so good. Yeah, I mean, sales pre-Christmas were really good. Like, I put the book out middle of November, and I don't have that many books left, a couple of boxes. I forget how many are in a box, the 44 or something.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, so somewhere, I don't know, somewhere around 450, I guess.
That's amazing.
All right.
That's very
good. Pretty good for, yeah. So I got hard copies done. They look pretty cool. Of course, you know, I do have And you know, the ebook, because you're going to do that, and people can get it also print order from Amazon if they want to go that route. You know,
that's smart.
I just today brought like 10 to our local chapters. So I don't know, we'll see if they sell there. The best, like one of the best sales routes that I went was Long and McQuaid here in Sudbury. They agreed to carry them, and I was just giving them parts like five at a time. They'd buy five at a time.
Yeah.
And I went back there four times. So that was pretty good. And every time I went, I'd run into somebody that I knew like in the parking lot or something, or standing in line for my buddy Matt Foy to put them in, because I know most of the guys who work there too. You know, to put them in the system or whatever. I sold a couple as I was standing there in line to people.
That's amazing.
You know, like, so I was joking. I said, you know what? I probably could have sold out if I had just stood at the doors at Long and McQuaid leading up to Christmas with the book out.
Yeah.
You know, want to book guitars?
Yeah. You should put it under your jacket. Like, hey, what?
Yeah, exactly. I think that would have worked out just fine. So
that's amazing that we're living in a pretty cool time that you can kind of manufacture something and it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg. And when I told Ron my idea, he goes, you know, I make books of poetry from my songs. I haven't sold shit. I'm like, oh, really? Okay, well, we'll see. And after I went through my third box, he's like, I was wrong, you know, because I would sell them at their shows and then they're sitting there signing it, right? Like signing my book. I'm like, I told you. And people love it.
I think that's a genius idea. And you know what? It also kind of satisfies. Two thoughts, because this is I have ADHD, and this is the second or third time this thought has come to my head. It will not come back again. but I do want to say when Ron shared the link to my website, I think it was, with Low Fans in the group on Facebook and on his own page. I gotta say, lowest of the low fans are really biased to action.
Oh yeah,
fans, you know, and I think it's because there is so much passion for this band, and people who, you know, nobody just likes Lowest of the Low; they love them. So like when he did that, there was like an immediate like boom, 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 whole bunch came in. The Tragically Hip, also very cool of them.
Oh, I'd imagine, yeah.
Shared on Twitter. And but the bump was like about the same, to be honest.
Really?
Wow. You know? So I really think that like you were onto something there, and low fans are gonna pick up a book like that. The other thing is that, you know, different people, you know, you're using different senses when you're reading a book as compared to, you know, watching, say, a documentary or listening to music. I'm not an auditory learner. I'm a visual learner, and people have different learning styles, right? So my wife can walk around and listen to a podcast or an audiobook or something like that, and be doing whatever else she's doing, and totally that stuff is getting into her head. If I change my attention from that podcast for 5 seconds, I'm lost.
Really?
I'm done. None of that's getting into my head. But if I can read it, you know, then I'm more likely or apt to remember it. And I'll just enjoy it differently. So I think it's a genius idea. And, you know, I'd like to kind of, you know, maybe work it the other way. Like, I think that... you know, because this idea is unique, it actually came from, it was inspired by a friend of mine's post on Facebook. He was talking about his Norman B-20, Liam Ennis. Mm-hmm. And he just wrote this little thing, and it was kind of a narrative kind of, you know, when I thought, oh man, that, you know, I was just kind of captivated by it. I liked, and it's in its original form in the book. I liked what he had done there, and that was kind of gave me the idea. Like, we all have this story. We all have this story. And I that thought sort of rolled around in my head for a while. So I dove for my phone, and I Googled the shit out of it, like, 6 Ways to Sunday.
To you just sure see that's not done it.
Yeah, and nobody had done it. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
That's amazing.
Nobody's written this book? Mm-hmm. So I asked Liam, I'm like, do you mind? Like, this is what I plan to do. Do you mind if I take this ball and run with it? He's like, no, of course. I'm like, knock yourself out. So did. And it's like you with the like you with your documentary. It took me about 3 years. Like this was mid-February of 2021. So we're kind of we're rolling into about a year of pandemic at that point.
Yep.
And that became my creative outlet. When the pandemic hit, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. Like, I might even write a new record. I'm going to spend a lot of time playing my guitar and shit. I haven't picked it up since, honestly. Like, I barely played. I don't have calluses on my fingers anymore. The last time I tried to give it a go, it was not impressive at all. and I've never been a good guitar player. I only learned cowboy chords and, you know, enough of them to write songs.
Yeah.
Because I didn't start playing guitar till I was 33. And I joke now that it's like I still talk about it like I'm a new guitar player, not like a guy who's been playing guitar for 20 years. Like I should be way better than I am.
Ah.
I suck.
Yeah, man.
But you know,
yeah.
I mean, it was just something that I had always wanted to be a campfire strummer, and that's pretty much what I got. I rose to my level of expectation and stopped right there.
I wrote a record, and I called it Three Chords, One Capo.
There you go. Yeah.
That's all you need, man. You need a capo and three chords. That's all you need.
Well, you know what the weird thing was is I had in the book, my first guitar story is actually it's about my friend Reggie's guitar, and he died in a motorcycle wreck, and I learned how to play guitar on one of his guitars from his brother. A bit of a circle of life thing going on, but my first guitar. I also talk about this in the book. It's Providence. I have no idea what it was called. I had to guess at it. It was like this red sort of kind of Strat looking thing from the Sears catalog. And the only thing I ever learned was the very opening to Fly By Night by Rush. Cause why wouldn't you tackle Alex Lifeson right off the bat?
Yeah.
But that has an E and A and a D in it. And I knew these chords my whole life. And if I picked up a guitar, I could play E, A, and D. Not well, but I could play them. Like, little did I know in my this desire to be a campfire strummer that I could have learned, like, 1,500 songs with those three chords and been fine, right? Anyway, so that's just I don't remember where I was going with that. Oh yeah, now I do. Yeah. Now I do. Thank you. It's coming back around. with the book is you know, I don't want this to sound weird. I don't want this to sound arrogant, but I think this is kind of like sort of a franchise ready idea, you know.
You could do bases next.
I could do first base, you know, I could do first skin, I could keep it for skins.
Yeah.
I could keep going because the source material will be endless with first guitars, really. Yeah. You know, I could write that book until people are like, could you just stop now, man? You
know? Here's the guy. Hey, you stop a guy on the street. What was your first guitar? Well, man on the street.
but you know, I think, but I mean, you know, is it crazy to think that you could do some kind of a video series, you know, or a podcast or, you know, some kind of a YouTube thing or, I don't know, like, you know, then you really could start spitballing, you know, like a concert series or something. I have this idea in my head that it would be really fun to, like, you know, book Hughes Room or something like that and invite all the players from Toronto to come down with their first guitar and play a song and just have a night that's just fun, you know?
Yeah, kind of thing.
I don't know if it's realistic, but
I think with the podcast, if you did a podcast, what would make it awesome is that they'd be just short little bites, like 15 minutes tops.
Yes.
And then that way you could just binge through it, but at the same time, it keeps the, you know what I mean? Because having a long form conversation about one guitar might not be something that's viable. Yeah.
Really. Then it becomes a little bit niche, right? If you keep it short, then you can basically get them to recount their story, ask a few more questions, play a song or two, and then you're out.
Take the interview, transcribe it, and you got book content.
Got another book.
Ta-da! Yes. Right. You can't lose, man.
Let's turn these all into free-form dance. We're going to do the interpretive dance version of Heartstrings First Guitars.
There we go. Yeah. How did you get the Heartstrings First Guitars name? Is that just...
I just came up with that.
Yeah.
That was just something. I don't know. Heartstrings sounded good.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully not cheesy, but that's what lodged in my head. Was Heartstrings First Guitar, so that's kind of what I went with.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I think it works on a number of levels. So, whatever.
So. We just burnt through an hour.
We did already?
Yeah, man. Yeah, I could. Dude. Yeah, I really I'm so glad I met you. This isn't going to stop. We got to just keep maybe catching up with each other over the period of the next couple of years. Because whatever you got something to do, you just let me know. I'd have you on every day, all the time.
I would love to do that, man. This was a great and very quick conversation, and I would like to do it again. And also, I would like to talk. I'd like to spend a whole hour talking about your documentary. You know, and interviewing you, because I've done that a few times, you know.
Yeah, man. I would love that. Yeah, for sure. And then when we get off air, I'll show you my first guitar.
Right on.
Okay, man. Thanks so much for doing it. I really appreciate it. It's awesome.
Thanks, Simon. This was great. It was a lot of fun.
And that was Sean Barrett, author of Heartstrings First Guitars. And that was that's a classic epilogue episode you'll get. Starts kind of, you know, hey, how you doing? We get to know each other, and by the end, we're old buddies. And that's what I love about the show, is meeting new people and getting to know them and understanding each other as artists, as people, and having a common ground and knowing all the same people. It's quite an amazing journey doing this podcast, because I get to meet good people like Sean. So, if you are in need of help, don't forget to go to betterhelp.com/ and enter the code word Apologue when you go, and you'll get yourself 7 free days of therapy. We're getting into this January, and well, happy 2024, by the way. We're getting into January, and things are getting darker faster, and it'll be a little while before we start seeing the sun and get some vitamin D in our skin. It's cold outside, it's snowy, and what better way to, you know, connect with somebody on a therapeutic level by going to BetterHelp? There's the pitch, everybody. I got nothing to sell, got no real updates. I'm starting a new project, starting two new projects, actually. One, I can't even talk about either of them because they haven't really gotten off the ground yet. But I'm in development stages of, I think, two and a half projects. I hope to, and I can't wait to share the information. And I also have some updates with the Lois and Low documentary that's coming down Main Street, and I'm just waiting for all the things to get locked up, and I will have announcements henceforth. So thank you so much for listening to this episode week after week, and I appreciate every one of you, and I will see you next time. And I'll try to, my New Year's resolution is to try to put out more episodes. I will try. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I will try. And I hope you do the same, as try to listen to the show. Okay? Have a good one. Bye.